I want to talk to you about TrueCar.com. TrueCar.com is changing car buying forever. Yes, every day, TrueCar users receive negotiation-free, guaranteed savings. Some features not available in all states. In the first 3 months of this year, over 126,000 cars were sold by the TrueCar Certified Dealer Network. TrueCar users save an average of $3,078 off manufactured suggested retail price. When you're ready to buy a car, just follow these three easy steps. First, go to TrueCar.com and find out what other people paid for the car you're looking for. Then, register at TrueCar.com to see upfront pricing information and lock in your savings. Third step is simple. Just print out your TrueCar savings certificate and take it to the TrueCar certified dealer for a better, hassle-free buying experience. Remember, every day, TrueCar users receive negotiation-free, guaranteed savings. Save time, save money, and never overpay. Visit TrueCar.com today. That's TrueCar.com.
Warriors, come out to play. Warriors, come out to play.
One game could run this city. One game. Nothing would move without us allowing it to happen.
Hey, folks, this week on the podcast, my friend Dr. Drew, you know him from Loveline, from his own show on HLN, his podcast. He's promoting prostate cancer awareness this month because he just dealt with a little prostate cancer, but he's all good. Really cool conversation with Dr. Drew about how he got started in not just medicine, but sort of became sort of the guy to give advice in all matters, medical, mental, sexual, all of it. Really, really cool guy, very hip. And one of the guys I think sort of is the most legit on television in terms of doing the kind of thing that he does. Really great conversation, and I think you're really going to enjoy it. I am going to be on the road. You got to come see me. I'm going to be at the Cleveland Improv October 16th to the 19th. I'm going to be in Austin, Texas at Cap Cities Comedy Club. Really great club there. October 29th, November 1st. Comics at Foxwoods in Mashpee, Connecticut. November 6th to the 8th. And the Omaha Funny Bone, November 20th to the 23rd. And then I'm in Columbus, Ohio, Denver Improv, and Washington, D.C. Improv in December. Come on out and see me, and enjoy the podcast, folks. A really cool conversation with my man, Dr. Drew.
We got the streets, suckers! Can you dig it?
Welcome to the podcast this week, everybody. I have Dr. Drew Pinsky on with me, who I was had a great time on your show, Loveline.
On Loveline, yeah.
Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
And thanks for being on. And a lot to talk about. And I know how busy you are, and I want to jump into it.
Yeah.
You had a bout with prostate cancer, and sort of on this campaign of prostate awareness, and let's jump into that.
I've never ever thought of it as a bout of prostate cancer.
Yeah, that's
but
true.
That's interesting.
That's
true. I had a situation where I had a low grade tumor diagnosed about 4 years ago,
right?
And my wife sort of really was able to identify that I wasn't. Didn't seem myself or something.
Yeah, I was reading in 1 year.
Yeah, I was sicker. I just got one illness that laid me out. I was just so toxic.
Yeah.
And she goes, something's wrong. That wasn't you. And I go, that bullshit. Let me just talk to my subspecialty friends. I'll be fine. She goes, you've never had a physical. Get a physical. I'm like, come on.
But you're in such good shape.
Well,
never...
that's case in point.
Yeah. He's got guns, by the way, people, just so you know.
And I watch my own cholesterol, and I see a cardiologist, and I do all the on the periphery, and I watch my own PSA and stuff. But in case in point, you can't be your own doctor. You got to have an objective evaluator. So I went to a guy, and the PSA went up. He had gone up quite a bit, but it was still normal.
Right.
Now, if I had been watching my own PSA, I would have stepped into a little bit of denial and gone, I'll check it again in 6 months.
You know?
But he was like, no, you got to see a urologist. I'm like, oh, shit. God damn it. Saw the urologist. He was like, oh, no, it must be prostatitis. Let's just treat that. Well, didn't get better.
What is prostatitis?
It's inflammation of the prostate, okay. which as a result of the biopsies I got, I ended up actually living with for a long time. Okay. But he goes, go to biopsy, and lo and behold, cancer. And it was so funny when it was when I was doing Life Changers, and he was supposed to call me like on a Monday with the results. Mm-hmm. And as Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday dragged by, and I thought, oh, I've got cancer, and he identifies too strongly with me to be able to tell. He's not to tell me.
Oh, really?
And I think that's what it was. I've noticed that when I have bad news, my physician friends really have trouble telling me.
Wait. This is counterintuitive. I would think doctors to doctor, it's like, hey, you know, this is what's going on. Let's get into it.
They hate to drop the axe. Yeah. I get it. I understand. You want to wait till the right moment. You have energy to really help through it.
Yeah.
And anyway, I went on an active surveillance program with the head of the Prostate Cancer Foundation, and I learned a lot about what's the available treatment options out there. And ultimately, last year, went and had a robotic radical total prostatectomy. And on the heels of that, I sort of went public about it, and people are like, oh, why'd you wait so long to go public? I was like, well, I want to make sure I was a good story, first of all. I don't want to scare people with my story. It could have gone bad. Who knows?
Right.
And I had a great story. Everything's great, and, you know, it seemed to be cancer-free and all. Mm. And so then I was asked to be on the board of the Prostate Cancer Foundation, and that's when I joined up and started doing press for them to try to raise awareness, because 1 in 7 men get it. If you live to 100, you're going to get it. Probably live to 80, you're going to get it, truth be known, with a high, high, high probability. But it's a different condition at different stages of life.
Yeah.
And there's different genetic variants, and there's different genetic risks, and your risk and your circumstance has to be evaluated with your doctor. And in mine, you know, the surveillance turned out to be a good thing, because by the time I got through that year of doing a daytime talk show with, you know, a surveillance. And,
yeah.
And by the time I was ready to, it was time to go, I was really ready. I was really psychological, like, let's go, I'm fine.
You're ready to do it.
Let's get this done.
What is the research showing? I mean, you know, I'm sitting here, I get checked, and I'm sure that something's going to come up with me at some point statistically, but... hereditary? Is it have to do
some hereditary? If you have a first degree relative under the age of 65, diagnosed under the age of 65, you should begin the PSA screening at 40. Everybody
at
else
40.
40. Everybody else probably 50.
Wow.
You know, if you have any prostate cancer in your family, definitely 50. Mm-hmm. The question then becomes, what do you do with the diagnoses of low grade tumors? You know. That's a very personalized decision.
What about the history? My mother's side, everybody has cancer, whether it's leukemia, Hodgkin's.
It's all hematologic malignancies.
Quite a bit of that, yeah. And sort of breast cancer. My sister, does any of that sort of, is it a telltale sign for prostate cancer?
No, not per se. Mm. Prostate cancer, the telltale sign is prostate cancer.
Yeah, yeah. No.
Though there is some association with colon and breast and whatnot they're trying to link.
Yeah.
And it makes me think of colon for you. It makes me think, you get your colon cancer screened carefully.
Yeah, I've had a couple of colonoscopies, and so far so good. Yeah. But, you know, I am a big asshole, so there's a lot to look at.
We have a lot to look at. It's easy. It's easy
right.
to look at.
Just go right in.
You're a big asshole. No problem.
You don't even need the scope. You're just, okay, there you go.
This guy's a big asshole.
So how are you as a patient, being a doctor and all of that?
Apparently I'm good. I did a podcast at my own podcast. I have a Dr. Drew podcast at drdrew.com. And I had my doctor on, a guy mm-hmm. named Skip Holden. Mm-hmm. And he talked about it. I mean, he talked about what it was like treating him. Apparently, I was good.
Yeah. Oh, well, we should mention, by the way, host of the Dr. Drew podcast, as you did, host of Dr. Drew on Call on HLN, 9 p.m. Eastern Time.
We're here at CNN now.
Yes, exactly, right in the Time Warner Center. Host of Loveline, of course, and we want to get the word out about the prostate and cancer awareness. One of the things that's sort of fascinating to me is that you had said in sort of the research that I sort of did on you that you're a non-observant Jew, in the sense of sort of your religion. You acknowledge religion, but as a scientist and so forth,
right.
That's sort of that is not sort of your focus, if you will. At being a patient and sort of looking at, not that you were sort of on a death sentence, but did you sort of take stock of that?
Yeah.
Point of view a little
yeah.
bit.
Yeah, and the research, you know, human research shows that as we get older, we get more religious.
Right.
And I'm no exception. So I have been more interested in the unknown as I've gotten older. And you know, my wife's into her whole thing. You've done her podcast.
Yeah.
And that's all some intuitive world that women tune into. I don't know what the hell that is,
but
I'm open to the idea of our brain is very limited capacity. Right.
And what, for my listeners, what Dr. Drew is referring to, his wife Susan, who has her own podcast, is very much into the spiritual and the clairvoyance and. They did a reading with me on her show, and I guess you've had a reading done.
I'm fascinated.
Do you believe in that?
I believe that women use a lot more of their right brain than men do, and they have much more access to it. And I don't like using terms like "do believe." It's just like, what's the evidence? Mm. The evidence is they're tapping into something. I think they're reading minds. I think they're tapping into something about us.
And they have a greater ability to do that.
They for sure do. And these women probably have developed something. I know that when I'm in treatment with patients, I get in that mind reading space.
Yeah.
It's a very magical space.
Yeah.
It's almost hypnotic and weirdly informed. It's weird. I mean, your body starts experiencing stuff you've never experienced before, and it's literally put there by the other person.
Why
couldn't some important person in my life be left behind in my cortex? And then I I communicate it in some weird way. All that unknown stuff, I've become increasingly fascinated by. I was a pure scientist my whole life, and then now I'm becoming interested in the unknown.
What was it about religion? My father-in-law was an OBGYN, and we had this conversation. He's since passed, but he sort of was of that ilk, too, of, you know, science is science, and that explained a lot of things for him. So what was that for you early on in your life, sort of? Religion is there, but that's not an explanation for a lot of things.
As some of the Catholics say, it's about how to go to heaven, not how the heavens go. And I was more interested in how the heavens go. And Judaism does not really have much about afterlife. And I wasn't really interested in that. I thought Pascal's wager, right?
Mm-hmm.
Pascal's wager is that basically you. I can never state it right, but it's that if you gamble that there is no God and you're wrong, you've lost everything. And there is an afterlife and
Right.
I think he got the wager wrong. The wager is if you lived your whole life based on human-created anthropological imaginary concepts and sacrifice elements of the lived life, you've lost everything. You really lost everything. Now, Judaism doesn't do that kind of stuff to you. I was raised until third grade in Saturday school and stuff like that. And so I was, and we had an extended family. It was very religious.
Mm-hmm.
I have always been very uncomfortable with the idea of inclusion and exclusion. Chosen and not chosen,
club
members and not club members.
It's a very quickish
special
concept.
Languages and special. I've been since I was a kid uncomfortable with that. I don't like that.
Yeah,
and so that was what first sort of got me to push back.
Yeah, your father. Go ahead.
My father was
a doctor.
His parents were. You know, his first language was Yiddish. My dad's first language. Wow. They're Russian, basically Russian. Ukrainian. What's right next to Ukraine, down below, Belarusian immigrants, you know. And
was he
peasants.
Very religious, or was it the same thing?
He was
a
scientist. Mm-hmm. I mean, he just was like, this was all nonsense.
Right. Now, your mom, a singer, an actress, more of a sort of lean toward religion?
Less.
Yeah.
Zero.
Yeah.
I don't even know if she had an upbringing, religious upbringing. Right.
But you played Tevye in the high school.
But I did. But that's right. That's my room.
That was your tip of the hat.
The remainder of my religious training.
And did you? I know you sing, and I know you sing opera.
Mm.
Do you still do that?
I still like to do that. I do it so infrequently that I hate to even say that I still do that. but my son has really picked up that mantle, and he is a real musician. He went to the conservatory and whatnot, and he is so far in outer space from where I was.
Is that right?
I just like hand it off. I do enjoy singing once in a while, though. I like it. I've got a good. I'm a terrible musician. I have a decent instrument. But that's what it boils down to.
Did you? Was there any interest, sort of, in seriously going into the arts, or was it clearly science?
No. I did the whole. You know, after first year of college. I went off to Amherst College and pre-med got my ass handed to me, and I got good grades, but oh my God, I was just depressed and overwhelmed, and I didn't know what I was doing or why I was doing.
I read somewhere like at 19 you were having panic attacks at 19?
That was later once I got...
I hope that's okay. I'm saying that.
I don't mind talking. I have anxiety disorder now. I just don't have panic anymore.
Maybe I have it. What is that? How does it manifest itself for you?
Jonah's anxiety disorder?
Yeah.
I'm just more anxious than the average person, you know.
Everything sort of rummages around in your brain.
And when I literally, you know, it's hard to calm down, and I have lots of preoccupations, and you know,
a little OCD thing.
A little OCD, and anxiety and OCD kind of go together.
Yeah.
And I've channeled it and used it, but you know, it drives my wife crazy and drives people around me crazy. But I'm like, let's go. Come on. Yeah, whatever it is we're doing.
Well, my nightmare is I get up at 4 or 5 in the morning and go to the bathroom.
Yeah.
And because I'm a comedian, I work at night.
Yeah.
And I drink a lot of liquids. Not necessarily booze, but drinking water, whatever, soda. And you're filled up, you know, more so than the average person.
Look, I do radio till midnight every night.
So you know, right?
And I have the same thing. Or I take coffee because I'm tired. And then that's it. Now I'm up at 4.
I get up and I cannot fall back to sleep because brain just starts going. And I got to do this, I got to do that. And then I start worrying about this. And then I'm reliving something I did 8 years ago. And, you know, I used to be a lawyer and investment banker on Wall Street. And I left to be a comedian. And it was that. And, you know, when you have you hit a bump in your career, you're like, did I do the right thing? And all of that. And it's sometimes hard to shut that down. And I don't know if I'm describing what you're...
No, yeah, that's true. Anxiety. Yeah, you should know that that's not normal. That's not what you call normal. And all those intensive career moves and successes and things, not normal.
No,
that's,
I know.
Yeah, that's all OCD and anxiety stuff. It serves you, right? It works for you. You can channel
the career. The career move wasn't normal.
Well, it's either I'm not talking about that. I'm just the your high intensity. Success driven.
Yes.
You know, that's either bipolar or anxiety.
Yeah.
You know, and or both or whatever. And it's okay. Yeah. You can chat. How can people get the stuff shit done? I mean,
yeah, I think it's a double edged sword. I do think that overachievers or whatever it is you want to call it, but there's a sort of side to that that you live with. But in your.
Well, it was out of control. So I was like, fuck this. This is everybody. They wanted me to do this. I'm not going to do this. That's not me, man. Yeah. I'm going to go do whatever. And I left college for a while, and then I went. Then I was depressed, so I went back, and I was like, oh, crap, now what? And then I started having panic attacks, and it was horrific.
Yeah.
And they mistreated me so badly.
Was it they were giving you medication?
No, they should have given me medication. They didn't even make an attempt at it. They told me to take a long walk in the woods. And I was like, dude, if I can make this stop by that, I fucking happily would.
And this is like '70s, '80s.
Mid-70s.
Yeah,
mid-1977. And, you know, I go down to student health, and the guy's like, oh, I don't know, you just...
Walk it off.
Get it together, dude. You know, it's like,
seriously?
Oh, yeah. Some old-time New England doctor was down there. Dude, this was his retirement work. He worked for the college. They had no real student health.
Right.
I think it's how I got interested in adolescent health. Because when I started doing medicine, there was no focus on adolescence at all. No, nobody. That's why I got on the radio. It was
in 84, and you were...
HIV and AIDS really compelled me to go talk about it publicly. No one was talking to young people about it.
Right.
No one.
Right.
And then... You know, people were barely acknowledging that young adults and adolescents were having sex, let alone at risk for STDs or HIV. It just wasn't. It didn't happen. Adults did that, man. It's a sexual revolution was perpetrated by adults. They never imagined that adolescents would pick that.
And this is the mid-80s we're talking about. This isn't this isn't the 1950s when our parents didn't talk about sex.
Condoms were behind the counter. You had to line up at the pharmacy and get the pharmacist to get you the condom.
Right.
Remember?
Yeah. And this is 84 when you were a med student.
Yeah.
And you started an Ask a Surgeon, which is a Sunday night radio segment, which led to another segment, which led to your first regular hosting gig on radio. And your focus on Ask a Surgeon was just that, information for adolescents?
Ask a Surgeon, when they described to me, when my friend first called me and said they wanted to do the segment called Ask a Surgeon, I was like, what in the hell are you? Oh, yeah, you use big words, it'll be really funny. I was like, no, come, please, don't be ridiculous. Well, they insisted, when I went up there, they insisted on calling it Ask a Surgeon, but it was STD and birth control advice. It was young adult. Yeah,
and was the radio now?
Same
show. Nobody's talking. Were they okay with? Was the radio okay with you talking about that content?
It was midnight to 3 in the morning. Yeah, they needed community service. That's why they invited me, because they needed to make it a community service show.
Did you have any interest in public speaking or being a broadcaster or anything like that?
No, I never considered it. But I always was sort of drawn into what what's going on. You know, radio, you got to remember, radio was influential to young people.
Yeah.
And I thought, man, it's not been so healthy in its impact. Maybe we can make it do something healthy here.
Right.
And I kind of asked guys, can I keep coming back? And we kept coming back once a week as a volunteer for 10 years. And if I was on call or something, I wouldn't come in.
What you had something that you called a burning bush moment at Aurora Lessons in Sinitas, if I'm pronouncing it, I apologize.
Burning bush moment.
You said that I watched these young people go from dying to better than they ever knew they could be.
Yep.
And I was like, whoa. For me, addiction exposes all of the brain mechanisms under the influence of a profoundly distorted primary motivation.
All true. I didn't call it a burning bush moment. Somebody else
did. Yeah, somebody did. Yeah. Where was the turning point for you where you started to say, okay, I'm going to fixate's the wrong word, but sort of focus some of my efforts, or at least a significant part, on addiction and helping people with that dilemma? I lost, in the last 18 months, 3 friends to addiction, 2 to drug overdose and 1 to alcoholism.
Good times, huh?
Yeah.
I was always drifted to what I thought was the problem of the time, and it was HIV and AIDS for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And I was working in a psychiatric hospital.
This is out of med school now?
I started moonlighting there. I was out of med school as a resident, and moonlighting there. Then I ended up running their whole medical services. So mm-hmm. I became like really good at the medical treatment of psychiatric patients. I was mm-hmm. interested in psychiatry. If I hadn't done that, I probably would have gone on to become a cardiologist. This probably would have happened if I'd not gotten so interested in what was going on
really?
In psychiatry. Yeah. And but all the sick patients were drug addicts, and you know, and that's where I was asked to go do my medical thing. And also, I became very good at withdrawal, which was nothing that was ever taught as a discipline in medical school. And there was a guy down there.
What does that mean? You became good at it?
How getting people using medication to get people through.
So methadone for heroin addicts?
No, never methadone. But yes, that idea.
No, well, isn't that
no? I use all kinds of stuff, but never another opiate.
But I thought that was common. No,
it is. It's bullshit. It's like, trust me. It's like I could get anybody off anything in 5 to 7 days.
Is that right?
Yeah. And pretty comfortable.
So there was a great reward for you to see these people sort of...
Well, no, I didn't know. I was doing the medical thing, and the whole time looking into those rooms with the 12 step on the wall going, what is that bullshit? That hocus pocus, you know, what's going on there? Then I followed some patients through treatment and watched them like grow. I couldn't believe it. I was like, what is this? So weird. I mean, I was used to patients going from acutely ill to chronically ill, you know, in medicine. That's sort of what you see a lot of. And this was, you know, astonishing to me that there was really something going on. So I just got more and more involved in it. And then I was asked to be an assistant director of a program. And then that director quit all of a sudden. All of a sudden, I was moved into the director position. I had to really train myself.
I was going
to
say, now you're not formally trained as a psychiatrist or a therapist. So would you have to go to additional
All sorts of continuing medical education and really pay attention and really
now it seems to me you talked about being a cardiologist. If you treat me and I have a heart and you treat me as well as you can, I haven't my father died of heart attack, by the way. Well, everybody on his side dies of heart, so those are my choices, I guess. Cancer or heart disease. Literally, he had angina. Jesus. He wasn't supposed to be lifting heavy boxes.
Destined
he had
a for life and comedy.
Right. And so it's like pick your poison. So that's you know, if I die of a heart attack, nobody really points the finger at you unless you're a complete fuck-up as a doctor. It's like, well, they did everything he could, and the guy, you know, they just had a bad heart, and he died. When you treat addicts and they relapse or die of an overdose, you in the third person, but maybe you more so because you've had...
It's closer to cancer. The model is closer to cancer.
Yeah, it's they point the finger...
These are chronic, recurrent, deadly diseases that, in spite of all best efforts, often are fatal.
But it's unfair.
I know what you're saying. You know, it drives me out of my mind.
Unfairly to you.
Drives me. You have no idea how painful it is. In fact, it's so funny. I'm like dissociated just to saying this. I'm like flat. Which is that when you go to do something good, you want to do good, you want to help people, and you do good, you think you're doing it, and then you're accused of doing bad. I can't imagine a more painful thing.
Yeah.
It's really an awful experience.
Well, one of the things that you, for me, you know, there's a lot of television and radio healthcare professionals, if you will, that sort of don't pass the litmus test for me and for a lot of people. But you do, because you never feel like you have any other skin in the game when I watch you or listen to you. And this is before I ever came on your show, and, you know, we've since, you know, kind of gotten to know each other and all of that. It's nothing to do with that. That I felt like, this guy's not bullshit. Like, I would listen to this guy. And I think that's probably why you connected with, on Loveline, with young people, because people may not be IQ smart, but what I've learned as a comedian is emotionally they're very, very smart, and they know when they're being bullshitted. Hmm. Like, my father was high school educated. My mother was high school educated. She's still alive.
But I had to learn that. Drug addicts bullshit me all the time, and I got pretty good at telling them. but they used to bullshit me all the time. That's kind of why, another reason I kind of got into it. Patients were like cleaning the floors with me.
Yeah,
because I was so anxious to be good, do it for them, whatever
so
they need.
Manipulate you.
Oh, they'd manipulate me. They'd call me in the middle of the night. Yeah, whatever you need. And they call like every night at 4 a.m. It's like, okay. You know.
So then you start laying down parameters.
Well, then I had to go to therapy to learn about boundaries, and I had to go do more training and stuff.
I was fascinated watching some of Celebrity Rehab, the way you would sort of, you'd have that empathy, and you'd be there for them, and then you'd be like, this is it. This is the way it is. And, you know, I saw some of that with my friend who was an alcoholic. And I went to visit him up in New England. Great guy. And it's just his life fell apart. His wife divorced and blah, 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 blah. I'm in the rehab facility with him. And it's like, I don't really need to be. It's these other guys. That whole thing. And I'm like, Pat, you're killing me. And then he ended up, they found him dead in his apartment from alcohol poisoning. He was 52. And so you have that ability.
Yeah, that's what they need. You know what they need is the thing. You know.
So then what do you do? Like, have you ever just told, I read somewhere where you told somebody one day you're full of shit, and the guy goes, you're right, I don't even know when I'm bullshitting myself anymore.
Yeah.
Like, tell that story. It's a great story.
It's one of my favorite stories. And it's, I wrote about it in a book I'm writing right now, in fact. And it's, it just stayed with me because it was so exemplary. And it was this young kid, a heroin addict, who I really had affection for. Mm. But I treated him like 3 times, and he came in after a near death, like barely skated by, near death overdose. And he came in and he was sobbing in my office, like, oh my God, you have no idea. This has been awful. I've lost everything. I'm going to die. I know I'm going to die now. I'm feeling it. I'm ready to work. And in working with addicts, you know, talking about this bullshit meter, I mean, you've got to like, you got to trust however your body reacts to them, and not just even your mind. Like how you, whatever. I just learned to trust whatever came out of my mouth, and all of a sudden, what came out of my mouth was, "You are so full of shit. I don't know what to do with you anymore." And while he's sobbing, right, and I was feeling the pain of his moment. Yeah. He was in pain. It wasn't like he wasn't in pain.
Right.
I just, some part of me knew that it was something wrong.
But you really felt that too.
I had no idea it was going to come out. That was going to come out of my
mouth. But you actually did not know what to do with him too, right? I would imagine. Like,
no,
you had,
I thought, well, we'll put him to you. No, in my mind, I'm thinking, oh, let's get going here. He's now ready. I'm thinking he's ready.
Yeah.
And I thought, then all of a sudden, what came out of my mouth was like, you're just full of shit. And he stopped and looked at me, and I thought, oh, here we go. He's going to punch me. This is it. What did I just do?
Right.
And I held the frame. And I looked at him back. And I thought, you know. And he said, I know. I don't even know anymore. How'd you know? I can't tell what. And that's the way addiction is. It makes them, they don't know what's going on. They're just completely, everything's distorted and bullshit. And that helped him. Oh my God. He just was then able to like connect with me and trust me and feel like.
So how do you know? Like, do you have somebody that you turn to and go, look, I got this thing. And is there a counselor that you turn to? Is it your wife? Like, how do you.
Me?
Like,
and then I was in therapy.
How do you know, like, what the right move is that you're making with some of these people?
Well, lots and lots and lots of experience, and then a team. We have a team. Always, you have to have team, cohesive teams when you work with drug addicts.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
And so the other thing you've talked about is called the mirror effect, which is celebrity and narcissism and sort of, I'm fascinated by that. And just talk about that for a minute. And
well, it's that, you know, that a lot of celebrity is a bid to regulate pain. You know, as many things are, as many sort of non-productive things are, like cutting and drinking and using and stuff. And I just could, you know, having talked and met all these celebrities over the years, I could tell they all had these childhood injuries and that they had these narcissistic injuries, and that, you know, being in the public and being loved and being a public, you know, was supposed to solve that problem.
Right.
And it helps it in the moment, but it doesn't solve the problem. And so they end up making lots of bad relationship choices and still having the usual mental health consequences of all that. And
so you got to deal with the underlying problem.
And in the meantime, the rest of it is, you know, they're amplifying the same problem the rest of the country is dealing with, which is all the childhood injuries right now. You know, offering that solution is the way to go.
Right.
It's not the way to go.
Well, listen, I can't thank you enough for being on the show. We have to do more.
We should do that because we could go on all day.
We're very scratched.
I know.
We'll do another one if we have to do it over the phone or Skype or whatever.
Okay.
But I know you've got a million things. Host of the Dr. Drew podcast, host of Dr. Drew on Call on HLN, 9 p.m. Eastern Time, host of Love Line, which I've been on and had a great time. And when I come back to LA, I'd love to jump on again with you guys. I had a great time when I was on with you. And September is prostate cancer awareness.
Yep.
So, and congratulations. I'm glad you're in good health. And
thank you.
Thanks for doing this. Great to see you.
You bet.
All right, that was Dr. Drew. We're going to do another one with him because we just, as he said, scratched the surface. And so just stay tuned for that. That's going to be coming up soon. And check me out doing stand-up. I am going to be at the Cleveland Improv October 16th to the 19th. Cap City Comedy Club in Austin, Texas, October 29th to November 1st. Comics at Foxwoods in Connecticut, November 6th through the 8th. Omaha Funny Bone, November 20th to the 23rd. And in December, I'm going to be at the Columbus Funny Bone, the Denver Improv, and the Washington, D.C. Improv. These are all on my website and on my Facebook page. And as always, keep spreading the word about the podcast. This thing's blowing up. And appreciate you guys tuning in. And I've been having some great shows in the city. Check out what people are saying on Twitter and Facebook. And I'm posting pictures. So if you're in New York City, I'm going to be out and about this week. So in the next couple of weeks, to the middle of October. So come and check out a show and hang out. I'm at the Comedy Cellar, Stand Up New York, Comic Strip, The Stand, Caroline's, all the clubs. And keep checking out what I'm doing on Facebook and Twitter because we're posting a bunch of cool stuff there. All right, people, thanks for the love.
We take over one borough at a time. Secure our territory. Secure our turf.
Because it's all our turf.